You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Restructuring, Subleases, and Insolvency. I'm pleased to hand the program over to Nathaniel Trelease of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, who will moderate today's program. Mr. Trelease.
Thank you, Stephanie. I am very pleased to welcome our speakers to today's program. Joining us from Chicago is Anthony Licata. Tony is a partner with the law firm Taft, Stettinius & Hollister LLP, where he formerly chaired the firm's real estate practice and is currently chair of the firm's administration committee. He has an extensive practice focusing on major commercial real estate transactions, including finance, development, leasing, and land use. He formerly served as an adjunct professor at the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University and also at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Joining us from Cleveland is Dove Frankel. Dove is of counsel with Taft, Stettinius & Hollister LLP, where he represents companies and individuals in bankruptcy and receivership proceedings, as well as out-of-court restructurings and workout matters. He represents lenders, creditors, buyers, and landlords across the country, including in defense and adversarial proceedings. In the next hour, Dove and Tony are going to guide us through the world of insolvency as it relates to commercial leases, probably specifically focusing on what we're seeing out there right now, which are defaults and insolvency in the retail space. What are some of the things that we can do as practitioners to plan for this eventuality? What does the law permit? What does the law require? And how can we mitigate adverse outcomes for clients, whether landlords or tenants? Tony, Dove, welcome to the program. Let's begin with a little bit of a backgrounder, where we are right now in the real world, out there in the marketplace for commercial space, specifically related to retail, which is where I imagine you're seeing most insolvency in terms of tenants and landlords. Tony, can you sort of sketch the backdrop of what we're seeing in this space?
Sure, happy to. And Nate, great to be with you. And it's a real pleasure to have Dove with us today, who has great expertise in these issues. As we're recording this today, in September of 2019, the stock market is at or near all-time highs. The unemployment rate is at or near the all-time bottoms of low unemployment. So we are in prosperity, and not surprisingly, in the office area, the industrial area, and obviously residential area, the default issues and tenants who can't perform under their leases is somewhat minimal right now. But the retail space, which Dove can talk to as well, has been in a very distressed situation. There's been a number of very major high-profile bankruptcies. In addition to that, lots and lots of small mom-and-pop type retailers have struggled mightily against the internet purchasing trend. And aside from that, we here at the Taft Law Firm, we have a substantial restaurant practice group representing both landlords who lease to restaurants and restaurant tenants. And the restaurants are always struggling because that industry is so competitive and so susceptible to changing trends. So even in this time of great prosperity in the country, we still have very real challenges. And as night follows day, we all think there's someday there'll be a recession looming out there. So now is the time, if you're making new deals, to be working and being very aware of what can go wrong. This prosperity generally doesn't last. There'll be a downturn at some point, and all of a sudden, all those clauses in these lease documents that people maybe didn't want to pay as much attention to during prosperity are going to come into play. And as practitioners, it's incumbent on us to make sure that we have adequately planned for and provided for what happens in the downside event. Dove, any thoughts about that?
Yes, thank you, Tony, and it's a pleasure to join you on this presentation. All of the comments about prosperity are all well and good. From my chair, what I see is retail bankruptcies are continue to accumulate at an all-time high. Companies like Sears, Toys R Us, and Gymboree are familiar to everybody. and have, as everybody knows, liquidated, resulting in a glut of extra space on the market. But as Tony pointed out, it's important to realize that for all of the large cases that everyone hears about, there's many multiples of that of smaller cases, particularly in the restaurant and fast food industry as well, of cases that have been filed where leases ultimately turn out to be rejected in bankruptcy, creating extra space. Records have been set the past 3 years for locations that have been closed within the Chapter 11 world. And the question is, even during this time of prosperity, are there places available to fill those locations? Are there vendors or stores that can take those spaces? And in particular, with Sears and Toys R Us, where you're dealing with very large spaces, landlords face a challenge to repurpose those for the smaller locations that are more readily leased.
And I think that if according to Bloomberg, sort of the online financial information periodical, a record amount of retail debt, tens of billions of dollars, are coming due this year, 2019, and next year, 2020. So we might actually see an acceleration of the retail apocalypse, if you will.
That's good business development activity for Dove, who specializes in this area. So,
well, let's talk a little bit. Let's focus. We want to talk about both what happens when the tenant defaults and also when the landlord defaults. But one of the cardinal virtues of any lease for a landlord, of course, and particularly for the landlord's lenders, is certainty of those streams of rent, right? So what
yep.
are some of the things that, Tony, let's focus on diligence. In the knowing that this is possible, knowing that not only in the retail industry but in a lot of industries that there are cycles, right, cycles that cannot be repealed even if interest rates are zero or nearly zero, that something like this would happen, what are some of the things that you do to diligence potential tenants?
Sure. Well, we obviously begin with a careful, and usually this is primarily undertaken by the client if you're representing the landlord. But the landlord will undertake at least some review of the financial statements of the tenant. You should ask for financials. If it's an entity, you should ask for either an audited or a reviewed financial. Depending on the size of the company, they won't have an audited one. They may not even have a reviewed one in the smaller cases. If it's a startup business, you want to inquire as to what their capital structure is and what the support is amongst the capital investors. And if the tenants don't want to tell you that information, that's a bit of a warning sign that this could be trouble. And then the other thing that's very commonly done is you try to obtain a credit report from one of the credit rating agencies. Dun & Bradstreet's the one that people most typically procure. Although I personally don't find their statements to be very helpful, they don't give you much meaningful information. So those are the main due diligence items that I think people typically engage in. Obviously, one of the great advantages of living in a Google-dominated world is that you can do background Google searches on the principals and on the company itself, and if it's a startup, you can get the names of the principals and run those Google searches, and I find those very important. The law firms all have typically access to the LexisNexis service, and so you can also
right.
obtain searches from those, and those can be important because you might find out that the person's got a troubled past, and you know this is a factor to be considered.
Are those searches becoming, are the diligence periods be growing longer, and are the demands for information becoming more thoroughgoing, Tony?
I don't necessarily know that they're getting longer, but they are absolutely becoming more thorough.
Okay.
I think people want more work in the same period of time.
So what are some of the red flags, other than obviously the absence of, forget about audited financial statements, reviewed financial statements, other than that, what are some of the red flags that you start to say, client, you might want to think twice about this?
Well, thin capitalization and not very much cash on the balance sheet or debt on the balance sheet. Most of these start, particularly if it's a restaurant, for God's sakes, They'll spend a bunch of money building out the restaurant, getting it open, and then if they don't have adequate working capital to carry the restaurant through the slow seasons or through the startup phase, and one highlight sensitivity you should look for in restaurant deals in particular is that it's not unusual for restaurants to try to get open without enough capital to pay for all the construction work, so you want to require that they escrow that construction cost or otherwise know that it's available. A lot of restaurants have opened figuring they'll use cash flow from the first few months of operation to finish paying for the construction project. And every time we've seen that, it almost always ends badly. And that's why you have this phenomenon sometimes of restaurants opening and then closing within a matter of 6 months or a year because they weren't adequately capitalized in the first place. So watch out for relatively low cash and or relatively high amounts of debt. And also you want to watch out for in the capital structure, if the capital is being put in as debt from the investors as opposed to equity, then the investors have a chance to pull the plug on it very quickly too.
Dove, any thoughts on diligence?
Yeah, I mean, from my standpoint, usually when I get in, I'm usually telling them, well, why didn't you look at this? And it's always amazing to me the number of lenders who are out there, even so-called sophisticated lenders, that don't even do basic, like in my world, basically bankruptcy-type searches, lien-type searches, to find out if the entity and or the individuals behind the entity, who very often are going to act as guarantors, are already over-leveraged. Sometimes lenders, in their zeal to make a loan, they'll sometimes ignore the obvious or not even bother to look for it. So from my chair, which is usually later, that's what I see.
And it's not just lenders, Dove. It's landlords. Usually landlords are even more lax than the lenders because they've got a vacant space and they're under pressure to try to get some rent for it. Transactions that they know might be troubled or might be a flyer, but right now they've got no rent coming in from the space, and if they can get some rent in, then that might be better than nothing, they think. But then, as we'll talk about, the challenges of getting a non-performing tenant out of there are worse than the continued vacancy. Sometimes you're better off to leave it vacant than to take somebody who's going to cause you trouble.
That's right. And we actually have a client that I've been working for the last number of years, and they have found it in their interest, before they enter into a lease, they'll actually call me and say, listen, take a half hour and run some bankruptcy searches on the entity and the individual, because they just simply don't know how to do it.
Right.
And we've had more than one situation where I've been able to tell them, I can't tell you whether this guy is a good guy or whether this company is going to make it or not, but what I can tell you is that this individual himself or herself has already filed bankruptcy in the last couple of years, and these are the people that they're planning to use as guarantors. So it's just that, to your point, landlords, and who sometimes are very unsophisticated, fall into this trap a lot, where they just, any tenant is better than no tenant, and then they realize that is certainly very often not the case.
Are we seeing, you make a very good point, as we see more vacancies out there and landlords are obviously chasing tenants because they've got a lot of overhang of unused space, are you also seeing that amongst the lenders in their zeal, as Dove just said, to get the loan, that they're, I don't want to say loosening underwriting standards, but their over-eagerness to do it is having them do some deals that might not otherwise be sound?
I would say... There's pressure on the banks to get money out, but I will say, in all objectivity, it's not nearly as bad as it was in 2006, 2007, where there was almost willing suspension of disbelief on some of this lending activity they were doing. By and large, they're much tougher this time around, so we're all hoping that will cushion the ultimate recession when it finally hits. So
all right.
Yeah.
Well, landlord and tenant decide to move forward. I'm financing, obviously, probably already in place. What are some of the things, Tony, that tenant or landlord can do, particularly landlord can do in lease to mitigate risk? Cash deposits, letters of credit, what else?
Sure. Well, the first of all, obviously, is the issue of security deposits, and you always want to get at least a month or two of rent in a cash security deposit. Obviously, and by the way, the extent to which the tenant balks or pushes at that can itself be a warning sign. If they're that thinly capitalized, that a month or two of rent in cash up front is a burden to them. That's a warning sign. Be wary of that. In a lot of cases, people don't want to post up cash. They'll try to put up a letter of credit, and you got really two concerns there. What's the bank that they're proposing to give you as the issuing bank for the letter of credit? You obviously want a bank that is preferably a bank that's got an office in your locale, wherever you are, so that it's easy to go cash the darn thing if you have to. And then you also have this issue in a lot of letter of credit situations, at least initially, they'll try to give you a letter of credit that's got an expiration date. And Dove, I don't know how many times in your career, but I've had this happen multiple times. You take the letter of credit, it's got an expiry date, and somebody puts it in the drawer and forgets about it, and then they call you about 2 days before the expiration date, and they're in a frantic scramble to try to cash it or get it extended. It is possible as part of a letter of credit process to provide for automatic renewal. The banks are not crazy about that, and they charge customers more money, so you can get into a fight. But wherever possible, you should obviously go for a automatic renewal on the letter of credit.
Finish your thought. I interrupted.
In addition to security deposits, relatively cut and dried, I think, as a topic. The next big category would, unless Dove has something on security deposits.
The only thing that I would point out, if you find yourself in a bankruptcy situation, letters of credit are, believe it or not, despite the various pitfalls that Tony mentioned, letters of credit can be a great savior, because most courts, there are always outliers, particularly on the West Coast, but most courts have held that letters of credit are not property of a debtor's bankruptcy estate. So therefore, as a landlord, if you're holding a letter of credit, you can often act on that right away without seeking court approval, without getting relief from the automatic stay. There are cases filed where, as part of a filing, a debtor will ask for a determination regarding the letter of credit. Sometimes that's a stall tactic. We had a case where that was actually a stall tactic requested by the bank because the letter of credit was about to expire. And what the lender was hoping was that in the course of the tumult of the fighting and the arguing over whether or not the landlord could go get the letter of credit, the letter would expire under its own terms. We were fortunate in that case to have a bankruptcy judge who was very sensitive, who basically told time to keep that letter of credit alive. Those are easier to get at than your typical security deposit, where you're going to need to go to the bankruptcy court to get stay relief in most cases. So in my world, cash deposits are great, and they have their use, and obviously you like to have them. But when I have a letter of credit, especially one, like Tony said, one that just rolls over on itself, I usually have a happier client for my landlord.
And, Tony, I security deposits are what they are. They're never going to be enough to really offset real losses in a lease. I think the bigger topic might be guarantees.
Sure.
That would be a diligence issue, enforceability, and how much worth are they really? Can you speak to that?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that guarantees get taken very seriously. Sometimes the guarantees are given by a parent corporation. Sometimes you have to be careful when you sign a lease. if you're the landlord, they will try to give you some entity that is in fact just a shell entity, and it may have the assets that are in that shell entity, but it doesn't have anything else. And if that particular location goes down, they can close the store, bankrupt the entity, and walk away. So you want to try to get a parent-level guarantee. And when you get into the issue of guarantees, there's a couple of big points. The first one is obviously, what is the credit of the creditworthiness of the guarantor? You have to do the same kind of credit due diligence that we talked about on the tenant itself. You should do all that due diligence and more, if any, on the guarantor. And then you have issues such as, where is that guarantor located? How difficult is it to pursue that guarantor on the guarantee if you were going to actually litigate that? And so you want to put into your clause in the guarantee, for example, the guarantor has to agree to venue in a local court where it's easier for you to sue that guarantor. They have to agree to consent to jurisdiction of that court, so they can't come in and challenge venue or jurisdiction. And we find it critically important to make that clause designate somebody who, and we always prefer a law firm or some ongoing entity, as agent for service of the process. Because believe it or not, when you go to collect on a lawsuit, you can screw around and spend weeks trying to get the defendant served. And I can assure you from my career experience, and Dove, you too probably, nothing puts a client into orbit faster than your inability to get the case moving because you can't get service on the guarantor. That's less of an issue, obviously, with corporations because you can always serve the registered agent. But there's plenty of individual guarantors out there, so be aware of that and prepare for it in your documentation.
Dove, any thoughts on guarantees?
No, I mean, really, it's the same thing for us. The only thing that I would point out is that you will have sometimes a debtor that will try to have the automatic stay extended to guarantors. It does not usually work, but it's tried more often, to be honest with you, in smaller settings where the debtor will basically come in and say, well, even though the debtor is a separate corporate entity, they're so intertwined with the guarantor, who might just be, you know, the individual behind the entity, and try to get the stay extended. It doesn't usually work, but it is something to be aware of. I have seen in a number of these documents more recently the idea of a waiver of the automatic stay. But I will say that those are usually found to be unenforceable. But otherwise, it's the same thing. You know, when an entity goes into bankruptcy, it only heightens the fiscal ability of the guarantor to pay. And as Tony said, it's critical to make sure that your guarantor is collectible to the extent that you can. And I'm always amazed, again, at the times when this just doesn't happen and they just allow whoever the individual is that's behind the company to serve as the guarantor without doing even basic research to see if that person has any assets.
No, Tony, thinking about this, thank you, Dove, for that. And Tony, thinking about this from the perspective of the landlord, are there any other steps that we can take to either reduce the cost or reduce the amount of time that's going to take to enforce that guarantee? And are the guarantees always enforceable? How often do you see that they're just not worth what they're written on, the paper they're written on?
Oh, I would have to say that the guarantees are typically, they will stand up in the court most of the time. The problem is, candidly, and this is a terrible thing for a lawyer to be talking about, but the process is so bad in almost all the major metropolitan areas. There are some states where it's better than others. Texas, for example, is a state where you can get relatively quick judicial process. But other states, Illinois is notoriously bad. I think New York is too, California, major urban centers. The caseloads that the courts are handling are so large, and the resources of the courts are relatively small, that it's just very difficult to keep these cases moving, and you move for summary judgment, and you know the lawyers on defense lawyers are very crafty at raising up arguments which ultimately get defeated. But if the guarantor is stalling for time, hoping to renegotiate some cap on his liability or something like that, and that is something we should mention. In a lot of the guarantees, you will see that the person who's going to be the guarantor will come back and insist upon some cap on their guarantee amount, and that might be a year's worth of rent, it might be 6 months worth of rent. And so if there is a cap, then what happens is it all becomes a game of trying to stall it out as long as they can and hope that the landlord will get tired of the expense and the delay and offer to settle. And I have to say that happens quite a bit because the landlord is in a cut-loss mode. It's already a disaster situation for them. They've got a vacancy. They're not getting rent, they're not getting their property taxes, they're not getting their property expenses covered, and they're paying lawyers to go chase the guarantor, and the guarantor is using every crafty technique in the book to try to slow down and delay and run up cost. And even if you put in the guarantee, which you typically do in the forms, that the guarantor is responsible for the costs of the lender in the collection process, it just is a long, grinding process, and a lot of people don't have the time or attention to want to spend on it. So that's what happens.
So let's say tenants in default. Ultimately, we don't want to go down the guarantee route for all the reasons you've described, the time it takes, the money it takes, whether or not they're enforceable. Talk to us a little bit about, like, the ability of the tenant to cure after default and whether it's a one-time default or a recurring default.
Sure. Your typical commercial lease will have a provision that says that if the tenant commits a default, and it's very important for the tenant to have these because they can, you know, people can be on vacation, people can get sick, all kinds of things can happen. They miss a rent payment, for example. So typically you have two categories of defaults. You have monetary defaults and you have non-monetary defaults. Non-monetary can be things like they're supposed to, wash their windows and they never do, or they're supposed to take their garbage out and put it in the garbage can and they don't, all kinds of things in retail settings that can be non-monetary defaults. So typically the lease clause will say that the tenant, on a monetary default, might get 5 to 10 days of notice to cure that default, typically after notice from the landlord. And so, and in a non-monetary default, you typically see 30 days to cure. And if from the tenant's point of view, and landlords will usually agree, you want that clause to say 30 days to cure, comma. But if the situation is something that cannot be remedied in 30 days, say there's some damage that's been done to the property and it's got to be repaired and it can't get repaired in 30 days, there's a clause that will say if the tenant is proceeding in good faith to diligently prosecute a cure, then the cure period is deemed extended for a period long enough to diligently prosecute and complete the cure. Now, there's two pitfalls, really, with that. The first one is you get into what we call repeated default and cure situations. Tenant chronically is late with the payment, or the tenant has a problem, they're not doing something, you notice them, they take the full 30 days, they cure it on the 30th day, a week later they default on something else, and so most landlords don't want to be in that recurring default situation. And so you'll typically have the law, a lot of times you'll see a clause that says that if a default occurs, say, three times, we call it the three strikes and you're out rule. If you have three events of default within any 12-month consecutive period, thereafter there's no more cure rights. You don't have to go through this game of default notice and cure, default notice and cure. If you're in a situation like that, this is a bad operator or highly struggling operator, and you know, landlords want it better off to cut the cord, pull the plug, et cetera, get it over with. The second issue in this recurring default or cure provision is that clause I mentioned earlier, which is the extension of time necessary to cure. That can be a real can of worms, depending on what the situation is. And so some landlords are tougher on that than others. Others are not as worried about it. But just be aware, as an attorney working on these clauses, that if you agree to that, you know, extension of 30 days in a non-monetary default, if the tenant's trying hard, that expect down the road that can be a source of trouble for you.
Dove, any thoughts on that?
The one thing that I have seen is, because it impacts in my world more, is simply a failure of the landlord to deliver a required notice or a delay in sending out a notice. We had a case where, because a notice was not issued in a timely fashion, a landlord lost the right to repurchase property at a substantial discount. And when we asked what happened, it just fell through the cracks. You know, this was a fairly large entity, this landlord entity. They had a number of properties, and it just didn't go out. And recognizing that sometimes landlords, you know, I assume that sometimes landlords try to solve these things with a phone call. But my advice to when I deal with landlords, let's say pre-bankruptcy, post-bankruptcy, you can't send these notices, but pre-bankruptcy is, if you have the right to send a notice, then you send the notice. Get it out timely. Get the clock ticking. It also, for a bankruptcy concept, you know, if you get the notice out and get the clock ticking, it gives a tenant less time to decide to file a bankruptcy, and sometimes you can do what you need to do before a bankruptcy is filed. That's what I've seen.
Okay.
Tony, we've got a tenant in default. Cure period has come and gone, or maybe it's, you know, three strikes and you're out. What are the remedies for landlord? Not only what does the lease provide, what does the law allow, and also, I think perhaps as importantly, how is the choice of remedy really influenced by what's going on in the market, right? There's a lot of open space, a lot of overhang of space, there might be one remedy that the landlord prefers to another.
Yeah. Well, typically, if you're the landlord and you're in a tenant default situation, obviously the first thing you do is you convert the security deposit. If you're holding the cash, you take it out of security deposit account, apply it against the tenant's rent obligation, and you send the tenant a notice that you've done that. That should enable you to, for accounting purposes, to book that cash now as rental income. Similarly, if you have to go through the process of cashing the letter of credit, expect the landlord to give the attorney a call. We could do a whole program, I think, Nate, someday on cashing letters of credit, because they are tricky, they are complicated, and beyond the scope of our discussion today, other than the fact that give yourself plenty of time, and I always tell the client, get that thing over there a couple of days before to the bank for presentment a couple of days before it expires, because banks are notorious about raising highly technical objections, like you didn't sign it in blue ink. I've had that one. Signed by the wrong person, didn't attach something that it was supposed to have attached. We've had all these. And of course, as you're getting closer to the expiry date, if there is no automatic renewal, banks get even more testy about it. So, you know, get that cashing of the letter of credit process underway, and get somebody who has done it. Try to find somebody who's done it before. If you're doing it yourself for the first time, I'm telling you, be careful. It's a lot of tricky pitfalls in there, and call the bank and ask them what they require, and make sure that if there's a screw up, it's not you, it's the client who screws it up. Second thing we typically recommend, at least in Illinois and some other states, you're able to terminate the right to possession, but you don't terminate the lease. That's very important. Sometimes the landlord, if they're a small operator, they don't know the difference, and they send the tenant a notice without talking to the attorneys first, and they say, you're in default, we've terminated the lease. Don't do that. If you terminate the lease, you've opened yourself to an argument that the tenant's obligation to continue to pay rent until you have relet the space is now terminated. So in Illinois, and I think a number of states, what you do is you terminate the right to possession, which means they're no longer allowed to be in the space, but their underlying liability on the lease continues. The next step we typically see is that we depending on the timing and so forth, we would, you know, proceed to bring an action for possession. In Illinois, we have a statute called the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act. They probably have different, you know, titles in different states, but basically you have to, you know, file a, you have to prepare a complaint, file it in a court that's got in the bigger urban areas. The courts typically have divisions. They have a law division. They have a housing court division. Forcible entry and action, detainer action, sometimes is its own division. So you have to prepare a complaint, get it filed. You have to get service. That's that service question we were talking about before. Then, and this is really where the delay starts to, you know, starts to run up. It can, you file the complaint, it takes a week or two to get the service. Sometimes you can't get the service from the sheriff, so then you have to go get a motion to appoint a special process server. That can take a week or two to get noticed up and entered. Then the special process server gets this, and then they've got 30 days, in, at least in Illinois, most states, they get some period of time to file their answer. What happens is on the, nobody shows up and files an answer, so that you move for a default. On the day the default is heard, somebody shows up for the tenant and says, "Judge, I just got hired. I need 30 days to answer." And at least in Illinois, that motion for extension of time to answer is routinely granted. Routinely granted. You can't even stop it. So you add all that up, Nate, and you're a good 90, 120 days before you're even in front of a judge on a motion for for a judgment of an eviction. Then if you eventually get your judgment, depending on what state you're in, it can take another 30 days to get that judgment over to the sheriff.
Right.
And get that sheriff executed, or get that judgment executed, and get an eviction actually conducted. So if you can, and this is the point I think we're trying to make, if you can negotiate a non-judicial way to turn over the space without having to evict the tenant, and from the point of view of if you're representing tenants, you should understand that time can be expensive to the landlord, and usually the space is sitting there. You can't relet it. You don't know what to do with it. That is a bargaining chip you have, which is to force the landlord through that process. And you might be able to bargain maybe a break on the rent that you owe. You might be able to bargain a break on the guarantee even in order to quickly and easily turn over the keys. Another remedy I want to mention, in some states, I guess, apparently, Nate, you're allowed to change the locks. In Illinois, you are not allowed to change the locks. That's a breach of the Forcible Entry and Detainer Act. So you have to look at your local law and see what you can do. And as I say, in Illinois, you cannot change the locks. That's another point, by the way, which drives landlords crazy, typically. You're advising the landlord, they want to go change the locks tomorrow morning. You say, "Look, you can don't do that. It's illegal, and you'll get a counterclaim on your forcible case." So that's something to watch out for. Then the last topic, I think, on the remedies issue, Nate, is, okay, so now it's a month, it's 2 months, it's 3 months, it's 4 months, but there's still four years left on the term, let's say. How do you sue for rent when the term still has time to go, and there, you get various treatments of that in different states. One thing you can do is sue for the accelerated rent, but in most states that I'm aware of, at least, if you're going to calculate the accelerated rent, you have to allow, take a deduction from the amount for the rental value of the space, because the tenant landlord can re-rent it and get some money from it going forward. And in fact, in Illinois, we have a statutory duty on the landlord to mitigate damages. You have to show that you've taken commercially reasonable steps to mitigate your damages, which makes your ability to collect that rent in the future even worse. And of course, Dove is going to now point out that you're in a lot of cases where you're suing for rent, you're wasting your time because the tenant is bankrupt anyway, right, Dove?
Yeah, very often you'll end up with that, and you got to be very careful at any stage, at any step in this process that Tony just went through. At any step in there, the tenant can file a bankruptcy. And if the tenant files for bankruptcy, the automatic stay clicks in. And, I don't know, I haven't practiced that much in Illinois, but I can tell you in Ohio, and particularly up here in Cuyahoga County, you do not want to be representing a landlord who decided to keep on rolling once they received the notice of the automatic stay. This is particularly a problem with larger landlords who get a plethora of mail every day, and sometimes these things sit and sit on someone's desk, and the next thing you know, you're getting a motion for contempt for violation of the automatic stay, and the client has no idea what's going on, and they call you and they say, "What is this?" And you say, "Well, they filed bankruptcy." "Oh, well, how are we supposed to know?" "Well, it says here that they mailed you something." And usually you get a call back about a half hour later saying it sat on someone's desk or it was going from one department to the next. And the judges here in Cuyahoga County, down in Columbus, and in Cincinnati have very little patience for that. So you got to be careful with those types of things. And as Tony mentioned, because the process itself can take so long, up here in Cuyahoga County, we have mandatory mediation on some of these cases. You kind of lose track of things, and it's not, it happens more often than you would think that this notice of the bankruptcy just slides by. And what some tenants will do, even though the tenants are really supposed to let the court know that there's been a bankruptcy filed and file a suggestion of stay in whatever court, the matter is, we have seen tenants that don't do that for the specific purpose of being able to proceed later for a motion for sanctions. And the courts, at least up here, they don't care. Well, if they should have filed a suggestion of stay, well, you're supposed to read your mail. So you got to be very careful.
Dove, this is a great point to segue into because we spent a lot, most of our hour talking about the commercial aspects of this. Let's talk a little bit about the bankruptcy. Can you provide us a framework of what does the bankruptcy code say? How is a lease treated? What are the rights of landlords and tenants, and what is the process?
Sure. The bankruptcy code has a section 365 of the bankruptcy code, which basically deals with contracts and leases. We'll talk about leases, but obviously a debtor can have contracts, maintenance contracts, all kinds of contracts that go out in the future. When it comes to leases, it should be pointed out that these provisions only deal with unexpired leases. And there's a lot of case law out there. What does that mean? When is a lease either expired or, as Tony was referring to before, terminated? And basically, if the tenant still has any hope of getting back into the property, right, if they have any right to come back, any cure period, or in a situation where, as Tony was discussing, the idea of terminating a right to possession but not terminating the lease, which we don't have really that provision here, at least not as clearly as it seems like it exists in Illinois, that can create a real problem. Because if the lease is still unexpired, the tenant has a lot of rights. The debtor tenant has a lot of rights with regard to such a lease. Primarily, they have three options. This is referring to a tenant that has filed bankruptcy. So this is your Toys R Us, your Sears, your Gymboree, your small restaurant. They basically have three choices. They can either assume the lease, which basically means they just want to keep the lease rolling. They want to stay in the space and things like that. And to assume a lease, they have to pay any amounts that are past due. They have to cure any monetary defaults, which they usually understand. And sometimes it becomes a negotiation between the landlord and the tenant as to the amount needed to cure. And we can go into that more a little bit later. So that would be assuming a lease. They can also reject a lease. Now, rejection of a lease in bankruptcy is a very strange animal because what basically happens is they file documents with the court saying that they want to reject the lease, which basically means they want to leave the space. And to do that, they have to basically give back the keys and, broom clean is usually often a standard that's used, although debtors will in their motions sometimes ask for permission to just walk away and leave all the stuff there and abandon whatever's there to a landlord, you know, various store fixtures and things like that. And they walk away, but a rejection of a lease, and this is something I can tell you almost nobody understands, rejection of a lease does not terminate a lease. It basically equals a pre-bankruptcy breach, which in most cases simply leaves a landlord with various claims, which we can discuss later. The third thing that a tenant can do is assign the lease over to a third party. You see this in a lot of the larger cases, which become sale cases, where those leases are assigned over to a buyer. So in the case of, let's use Sears, Sears basically sold a large portion of their business to an entity controlled by Mr. Lampert. And in conjunction with that, a number of leases were assigned over to the buying entity. So the way that that works is the leases are typically assumed by the debtor and assigned over. One of the big fights that always happens in those cases is how much has to be paid to cure defaults and who's going to be on the hook for that. But when you're talking about a tenant bankruptcy, those are generally the three options that are there.
Can you speak to us a little bit more, Dove, about sort of the, well, Tony, do you have any thoughts on the general framework? How do you see it from a commercial lawyer's perspective?
When you have the tenant who's filed, you got to remember, as Dove mentioned, basically if the lease gets rejected, then the landlord, I believe, Dove, is treated as an unsecured creditor for a rent claim, right? But the reason they're in bankruptcy is they don't have any money.
Well, you know, that's funny. My mother, God bless her, she all the time, whenever she reads about these bankruptcies, she'll tell me, I don't understand how you, I read that Weil Gotshal just collected $100 million in fees. Do they not have any money? And sometimes that's certainly the case, but when it comes to leases, the rules provided by the bankruptcy code afford companies like Sears and Toys R Us the ability to get out of locations that are not performing. And as Tony mentioned, as a general rule, the claims that you're going to have in connection with the rejection of the lease, be they claims for amounts that were owed as of the petition date, or be they a claim that you have for rent going out into the future, which is subject to certain caps. But regardless, those claims are all going to be treated as unsecured claims, which when you talk to your landlord client and they say, well, I've got a claim for $2.3 million, let's say, against Sears, how much am I going to get? And you tell them you'll be lucky to get $5. You're usually met with silence on the other end of the line. You know, it's not a very pleasant conversation, and it serves only what it does do, depending on your relationship with your client. Sometimes you're able to say, you see, aren't you glad now that you got that big letter of credit that we pestered you to get? Or aren't you glad that we, you know, when you were looking at a guarantor, we made you a little bit nuts to make sure that you had a guarantor that was actually collectible? Landlords in bankruptcy, even though there have been some changes in the laws over the last 15 years that help them, very often have to sit and wait to see what a debtor is going to do, and that is very frustrating, particularly if the tenant decides at that point in time to pay no rent, or what we see a lot is tenants that take liberties and make partial payments.
So, Dove, let's talk a little bit about that, because you already talked about how landlord is getting a plethora of mail every day and something may move from one department or another. Somebody may be on vacation or may be overlooked. When investment capital is at stake, time is always of the essence. What are some of the timing issues involved here? How long does a debtor have to make initial decisions here to assume or reject the lease?
So what happens is, just to give you a little backdrop, prior to 2005, there was an initial 60-day period that a debtor had to make a decision, but they could get unlimited extensions. And it was not unusual for debtors to have years to make these decisions. For landlords, it was just horrible. On the one hand, maybe they were getting the rent, but from a planning purpose, because rejections happen very quickly. As a matter of fact, just to go on a tangent just for a moment, in larger cases, you'll sometimes have as part of first day filings a notice of a rejection where they're rejecting numerous leases basically right out of the chute. But because the landlords were in that predicament, which was probably not what Congress envisioned when they wrote the section, in 2005 they changed it to the present, which is where a debtor has an initial 120-day period to determine whether to assume or reject a lease. So that's basically 4 months to make a decision. Now, during that time, they're supposed to pay their rent, but they have 4 months. Prior to the expiration of that 120-day period, they can ask for and usually will receive a 90-day extension. All they really have to say is, we need more time. And as long as they've been paying the rent, unless they're doing something weird, I've seen it, where it was discovered that they were conducting illegal activities on the premise and things like that. But other than that, you're going to get that 90 days. So for all practical purposes, the debtor has 210 days, basically 7 months, to make a decision. However, two things. Number one, once they get that first extension, if they want another extension, they can only get that with the written permission of the landlord. And the courts are very serious about that. They're going to need a written, they have to file their motion for an additional time, and usually they'll attach it. These periods of time are very strict. We had a case recently where we were, fortunately it worked out for us, where we represented a landlord where a debtor did nothing in the 120 days. 120 days came and went, and they didn't file, they did not assume the lease, they did not reject the lease, and they did not ask for an extension of time. And we filed and we were able to obtain an order from the court directing the debtor to leave. The debtor actually appealed that twice within a very short period of time, and those appeals got shot down. So these are deadlines. There are deadlines and there are deadlines. As Tony, as more experienced than me can tell you, there are deadlines that, okay, big deal. These deadlines, there's almost no way around it. So if you're a landlord, as I've said, you have to really pay attention to these things. And I've always told, sometimes these cases start, as a simple landlord-tenant dispute and are being handled by, someone in another department, let's say within a law firm. Once a bankruptcy gets filed, you really have to, at a minimum, at least talk to someone who's familiar with that arena so that you can set these deadlines on your calendar. Because if a debtor misses that, that can really give a landlord an opportunity. It's one of the rare times when the landlord will have a tremendous amount of power and a tremendous amount of leverage.
Dove, you spoke. We're running near to the end of our time, but I do want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier, which is, let's say tenant rejects the lease. What options, what remedies does the landlord have?
Well, if a tenant rejects the lease, so the tenant, the rejection will only be effective once the tenant leaves. But once that happens, assuming the tenant leaves, the landlord is really left with various types of claims that it asserts in the bankruptcy case. You have a claim for rent that was due as of the pre-petition, as of the petition date. That's one claim. You have another claim. You may have another claim for rent that was not paid while the tenant was occupying the space. That type of claim is called an administrative expense claim, and actually jumps to the top of the hill. So those have to get paid 100 cents on the dollar if a plan ultimately is going to be confirmed. And then you have this rejection damages claim, which is for all of the rent due under the lease going forward. That amount is capped by 1 year's rent or 15% of the total due. Those are going to be unsecured claims. Now, the landlord, certainly in those cases, as I've said, if they have a letter of credit, they can go hit that letter of credit right away. It's not usually deemed to be property of the estate. or it can proceed against guarantors. If the landlord, if there's a security deposit, however, the landlord usually will have to obtain relief from the automatic stay to tap that deposit. It's usually granted, but you do have to go through the motions. And, of course, there's always a duty to mitigate. As Tony mentioned, the landlord's always going to be under a duty to mitigate the damage that's caused, the financial damage.
You can mitigate the expenses that go into that specific, portion of your shopping center, if you will, but how else do you mitigate? I'm curious. Maybe you turn off the lights, utilities, maybe you save in that sense but what are some of the other ways you mitigate?
Well, the biggest thing I think, Nate, is that you have to show that you have aggressively proceeded to try to relet the space. You have to put up a sign. You have to have a broker who's leasing the space. You have to show that you've taken steps to try to market the space. You can't just sit there and say, well, I don't have to do anything because every month I get it. I can sue the tenant or the guarantor for another month of rent. And at least in Illinois, you have some affirmative duty to try to relet the space. And, you might have to actually spend some money, repositioning the property and so forth. So, that's the main point.
Yeah, I mean, once the tenant is out, you can do whatever, you can turn off the lights. But, for example, if you're up here in Cuyahoga County and a tenant moves out in November, you're not going to turn off the heat. Because, and security and things like that, which particularly if it's a space within a shopping center, there's a limit to how much mitigation you can do. In the bankruptcy context, those types of arguments are always brought up by guarantors. Guarantors are the ones that are saying that you didn't mitigate and therefore, my guarantee, which as Tony mentions, is often limited either in dollar amounts or in time. They're the ones that will come in and say, no, because you didn't do anything. And the courts will listen to that. I mean, if you have a landlord that just sits back, they could be in for an unpleasant surprise when they try to collect all that money.
Well, gentlemen, let's pause for a moment here. Let's see if we have any questions from our audience, and I'm going to come back to you in a moment. Stephanie, can you provide our listeners with instructions on how they can ask any questions they may have?
If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touch-tone phone followed by the 1 key. That's star 1. To get out of queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
So, Dove and Tony, I want to talk briefly about everything has gone wrong. We have a tenant in default. Tenant hasn't cured and perhaps wants to engage in some sort of workout of the lease, renegotiate the terms of the lease. Give me some of the considerations, maybe some of the strategies that landlord might employ or to renegotiate the lease or really even just determine whether or not they want to do that. Tony,
sure.
I'll start with you.
Yeah, quickly, because I know we have a limited time now. Most important thing, if you're a tenant and in this situation where you have to go ask the landlord for rent relief, you have to take an open book approach to the financials. You just can't go into the landlord and say, I'm not making it, I can't pay the rent. You're going to have to show the landlord your proof of your sales. You're going to have to show him what your costs are. You have to demonstrate, landlord's not going to be very sympathetic if you're paying the store manager $200,000 a year, and that's why you're not making it. So you have to take an open book approach. You have to show the landlord that the tenant really is going broke. And then the landlord, second step of that is you have to determine whether there is a viable survival plan. Can a rent break really save the day? And if that's the case, if we just cut the rent, and the typical thing to do is look at what has been the sales pattern or if it's a restaurant, what's their income pattern. If they're on a path towards profitability, you may conclude that it's reasonable to cut them a rent break and see if they make it. Give them 3 months or 6 months, however long you think you might need to see the turnaround plan. Or maybe they're going to change their product mix if they're a retailer, try to sell something that has a better margin or sell something that's more popular with the buying public. Is there a survival plan that really makes sense? And then last but not least, from the landlord's point of view, is the landlord better off if the space is lit or if it's dark? In a lot of mall situations, particularly, it's very important not to have dark, vacant spaces And in a lot of cases, you're better off to have the space open and lit with some activity going on than to have it and be getting very little rent for it than to have it completely dark because you're getting zero rent anyway, assuming that this is a tenant who's gone bankrupt. And so those are the three big factors, I think. Open book approach, determine where there's a viable survival plan, and for how long is it going to take to get a turnaround, and number three, are you better off if it's lit or if it's dark?
Stephanie, do we have any questions from our audience?
There are no questions at this time.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've arrived at the end of our hour. We could go on. So let me remind you that if you have a question which you weren't able to ask during the program, or maybe one occurs to you later in time, both Tony and Dove's contact information, email address, and phone numbers have been provided on the written material distributed with this program, and we encourage you to reach out to them directly with those questions. Once again, my name is Nathaniel Trelease, and on behalf of Tony Licata, who joined us today from Chicago in the offices of Taft, Stettinius, and Hollister, and for Dove Frankel, who joined us from the Cleveland offices of Taft, Stettinius, and Hollister, we thank you very much for your time. Stephanie, I return the program to you.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's teleseminar.